14, we will continue our study in Isaiah, and it's my intention not to dwell too much in this particular section. We have to make some choices about where to kind of skim through a little bit, and even though we're going to take two sections to deal with Isaiah, because it is one of the longest books in the Bible, and one of the most quoted in the New Testament, and one of the deepest and most profound. I mean, in a lot of ways, people describe Isaiah as the Paul of the Old Testament, and I think in a lot of ways that's an apt analogy. But we certainly want to focus particularly more on chapter 40 through 66, for one thing, and so some of these parts we will kind of just deal with more briefly. Again, to kind of set this in its overall framework as far as the first half of the book is concerned, we had the introduction, which kind of culminated with Isaiah's call to go and preach to the people. And that message then is basically a twofold message, the one that we see here in the first half of the book, which is that the people of God of Isaiah's day, Judah, had some choices to make about whether they're going to trust in the Lord or not. And that was exemplified in the failure of Ahaz to trust in the Lord in dealing with the Assyrian problem, which is dealt with basically in the first section here, chapter 7 through 12. You remember Ahaz was confronted with an alliance of the Syrians and the northern kingdom of Israel, to come and depose him from his throne and put a puppet king in his place. And then, along with the armies of Judah, they were all going to go fight the Assyrians. And Ahaz didn't want to have any part in that. And Isaiah tries to counsel him to trust the Lord. All of this will come to naught. He just can't bring himself to do it. And that's going to be paralleled at the end with his son Hezekiah, who, although he's not perfect and he makes a lot of mistakes, in the end, his faith will prevail, and he relies upon the Lord, and you see how the Lord can deliver his people from the very same Assyrians. And we're now in this section in between those two historical sections that deal with the Assyrian problem that Judah faces under Ahaz and then Hezekiah. And basically the thrust of this section is that God is sovereign of the nations. He is the true king. Earthly kings come and go, but he has seen the king reigning upon his throne, who is none other than the Creator, Jesus Christ, and he rules over the nations of the earth. And then we've broken down this section a little bit in more detail, where chapters 13 through 23 focus on God's judgment over the nations. There's a series of oracles, and this is the section we're in, so we're going to look at it more detailed on the next slide. And we'll just, skip over these next ones till we get to them. So looking at this judgment on the nations, the thing in particular I was pointing out last time we were together is that this section is bracketed by using two of these mighty world cities, Babylon and Tyre, to bracket this section, and that Isaiah's interest in them is not just in Babylon specifically or in Tyre specifically, but in what they represent. And Babylon represents that same Tower of Babylon, Babylonian spirit. Man can just pool his resources and use his accumulated knowledge and military strength and economic power and everything else that he can pretty much do what he wants. And man will rule over the nations of the earth. No, God is still the true sovereign and king. And this will become apparent as we get to toward the end of chapter 14, that the Babylon that the world has to deal with currently in Isaiah's day is not literal Babylon, but Assyria. And I think we'll see that quite easily. And then we mentioned chapter 23, the oracle against Tyre. When you get to the book of Revelation, for example, John talks about the Babylon frequently in the book of Revelation. And instead of using a lot of passages about Babylon from the Old Testament, he actually uses a lot of these references to Tyre from Isaiah 23 in Revelation chapter 17. So again, it suggests that Tyre is not really Tyre, the literal city, as much as it is what it represents. Now, don't get me wrong, I do think the oracle is about the city of Tyre, and it came true, and everything that Isaiah said was going to happen happened. But to minimize it to that and say, oh, Isaiah's looking in a crystal ball and he's seeing predictions of the future about various cities, and here we are 2,000 years after Jesus, and we say, well, so what? Other than just a basic lesson, okay, God knows the future, what do we get out of this? But that is to miss the point. Any nation like Tyre, any nation that exhibits this Babylonian spirit, this human pride and arrogance and so on, and of course it's not just nations, but even we as individuals can be guilty of this kind of human pride and arrogance, and it will come under God's judgment. And so there's still a timeless lesson here for us. And ultimately, what God has been trying to do from the very beginning is save us from this Babylonian spirit. Save us from ourselves. Our own worst enemy is self. And Jesus came to destroy this Babylonian spirit. You might think of Paul's language in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 as he uses very militant language that we wield the gospel. We have weapons for the right hand and the left hand to cast down every thought that raises itself up against God, and to take every captive, every thought of man, and so on. Well, that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. It's the war is not so much a literal war against a physical empire or city. It is the city of God versus the city of this world. It is the domain of God's kingdom versus the kingdoms of men. God's rule and His will prevailing over whatever it is we think we want to do, or our will prevailing, or us ruling. And again, that can be in a very individual level as well. But of course, this is all said by Isaiah in a specific context dealing with the Assyrian problem. And I think in particular, it focuses upon the time period of Hezekiah. We're going to read about the death of Ahaz in chapter 14, and that helps us to give some context historically and chronologically to what's going on here. And I think it helps to explain what's happening in these chapters. And I'm not quite sure how far we'll get through this, but after establishing the Babylonian theme and indicating to us that it's really Assyria that he's talking about, he then turns his attention here. You can see I've grouped them together, oracles against Judah's neighbors, chapter 14, verse 28, so Philistia and Moab and so on. And then Egypt in chapter 19. Now what all these basically have in common is, if you're living in Judah, and the prophet comes along and he says, Philistia has come under God's judgment and weak, Moab is weak, what does that mean for Judah? Oh, that's good, right? That's like, oh, in the days of David will come back, because David subjugated the Philistines and the Moabites, and all these other surrounding nations were tributaries, you know, vassal kingdoms under the control of a kind of a little Israelite empire under David and Solomon and so on. And so here's hopes that these days could be somewhat renewed and come back. And Egypt is weak. And Egypt, of course, was always a great world power trying to stick their oar in and affect politics in the region and so on. So they're weak as well. But what we're going to find out is in chapter 21, all of these turn out to be false hopes on Judah's part. What's going to happen is Babylon will actually rise up and revolt against the Assyrian Empire. And if anyone had the best chance for revolting and overthrowing their Assyrian overlords, it would have been the Babylonians. They're the most powerful. They had everything in their favor. And yet the Assyrians put down that rebellion. And then it's kind of like dominoes. All of those who bought into the Babylonian revolt and hoped that would spell the end of the Assyrians and break their grip over these other kingdoms, then you just see these kingdoms following one by one. And in this geographical depiction in chapters 21 and 22 shows the Assyrians getting closer and closer and closer till finally they're on the doorstep of Jerusalem. and there is no deliverance for Judah from the arms of men or human intrigue or planning or any other human thing. The Babylonian spirit is self-defeating. You put, you know, the one that lives by the sword dies by the sword. That's the principle we're going to see here. You put your confidence in the spirit of Babylon and you think you're going to be able to oppose the Assyrians on their same terms, you are vastly mistaken, because this is under God's judgment, and that will include Judah. And so the only hope for Judah's deliverance is to put her trust in the Lord, and again, to Hezekiah's credit, he will eventually get there. So that's kind of the big picture overview of where I'm going to try to take us with this. I guess I ought to pause and see if there's any comments or questions related to that overall picture.
The rise of these various nations, the Assyrians, Babylonians, and so on, was it principally because of a leader and leadership that caused those nations to be strengthened and warlike?
Well, that's an interesting question. Guy asks about what caused the rise of these nations. Is it particular personalities or leaders that arise? And of course, the ultimate answer is God orchestrated all of this, and you know, nations rise and fall according to His will. But it is somewhat remarkable that with the appearance of Tiglath-Pileser, for example, in 745 BC, that's really when this Assyrian dominance begins as an empire. Now, they had periods of strength they had shown before, and again, I think personally, those were warning shots across the bow, so to speak, to his people in Israel and Judah. I'm going to give you a window opportunity here to get your act together. You know, the threat comes close, it's perceptible, but it withdraws. And so, you know, a thinking person might say, ooh, that was a close one. Maybe we need to reconsider our ways and repent. But I suspect what happened with a lot of people was, well, there you go, you see, we're the chosen people. Nothing bad will ever happen to us, you know. And with that kind of mentality, we've got our king, we've got our land, we've got our temple, we've got nothing to worry about. We got these lucky rabbit's feet, you know, that will keep the enemies at bay. That's what spelled the doom for God's people. But it is interesting. You know, you look at someone like Alexander the Great, of course, a much later period, but it's almost inconceivable a person just by his own, you know, personality and intelligence and so on could do all the things that he did. It just smacks of someone that God is with. And I think that is also true here of this Assyrian period, because as we said, it begins rather suddenly with Tiglath-Pileser. It's not like over, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years they just gradually build up into this world empire. It comes on the scene rather sudden, and then, you know, within 150 years, it's gone. It's completely disappeared. Again, the height of Assyrian dominance was in the latter part of the 600s, and yet within just that generation, it was completely destroyed and gone. And that just, again, smacks of some divine providence of raising up this tool. Remember, as Isaiah refers to it, the rod of my anger, my instrument I created in order to chastise my people. And when that job was done, God raised up another chastiser to punish the Assyrians for what they had done. So I certainly see in the rapid rise and fall of these nations, and the same thing will happen to the Babylonians as we see, that certainly appears to be God raises up certain persons like Nebuchadnezzar, and then as soon as Nebuchadnezzar dies, the Babylonian Empire is practically over with. So it is related very much so to certain individuals, but again, I would attribute their success ultimately to God's divine providence. I don't think any human being could just be that lucky and talented and so on. So, Lawson?
Was Tyre overthrown several times before Alexander?
Well, it certainly, I think, had suffered, you know, various periods. I don't know how you define the way Alexander overthrew it. No, Alexander pretty much. Yeah, but even then, of course, it was rebuilt in some sense locally, but not, you know, the original spot there and so on. But yeah, Alexander certainly did a thorough job. So that's more for Daniel, I guess. Anyway, all right, well, let's look in chapter 14. That's where we were last time. And as we noted, a lot of people read chapter 14, about, it's, you know, the fall of Satan. You look at verse 12, how you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, or shining one, Lucifer. That's where we get the name Lucifer for Satan, son of the dawn. You've been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you'll be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit, and so on. And again, I don't argue with the fact that, you know, if the Bible didn't say one word about the origin of Satan, you would have to conclude he was a created being. He wasn't created inherently evil. He had to have the choice to be evil. Otherwise, that would make God culpable, it would seem, in creating evil. And therefore, he in some sense is a fallen created being. And it was his pride and arrogance and so on that resulted in his fall. But whether the Bible ever actually addresses that, I think, is a serious question. And certainly here in chapters 13 and 14, you know, Isaiah has clearly labeled this as an oracle about Babylon. And so the most you could say is that Isaiah is using this image of the fall of Satan to correlate that and use it as an analogy for the fall of Babylon. But even then, I think that's a little tenuous. I think clearly here in the context, Isaiah is portraying Babylon, this Babylonian spirit, this haughty human arrogance and pride, exalting itself up to compete with God, to be equal with God, as something that God will not tolerate and God will bring under judgment. And just like in the beginning with the Tower of Babylon, that will repeat itself and God will bring it to naught. And so, notice how this ends. Verse 22, I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and will cut off from Babylon name and survivors, offspring and posterity, declares the Lord. I will also make it a possession for the hedgehog, swamps of water. I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord of hosts. So just utterly destroy it, and it'll become a desolate place for wild animals, you know, that kind of thing. Now, here's the interesting thing. Notice, beginning in verse 24, the Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely just as I have intended, so it has happened, just as I have planned, so it will stand, to break Assyria in my land, and I will trample him on my mountains. Then his yoke will be removed from them, and his burden removed from their shoulder. This is the plan devised against the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out against all the nations. For the Lord of hosts has planned, and who can frustrate it? And as for his stretched out hand, who can turn it back? And so it's a statement about what God's stratagem, his planned purpose is. But you notice again, who is it he's talking about specifically here? Assyria. And so, you know, if you're reading this as a catalog of nations God's, you know, got oracles about, you know, Babylon, you're reading for two chapters, Babylon, and suddenly, and this is what I'm going to do, I'm going to break Assyria. Wait a minute, we hadn't even been talking about Assyria. What do you mean about this? Well, I think the best explanation is literal Babylon is not the problem. It will become the problem 100 years later that Judah will have to deal with. But currently, the great, you know, 900-pound gorilla in the Mesopotamian world is the Assyrians. And they're the real threat, but as we've been saying, it's not really the name on the door, you know, it's the same old business, you know, that keeps changing names. It's the same old Babylonian spirit that keeps coming back, and this time it may be the Assyrians that are the ones exhibiting the Babylonian spirit, or it may be the literal Babylon that's exhibiting the Babylonian spirit, but it doesn't matter, you know, and the Greeks and the Persians will have their turn at it, and ultimately the Roman Empire. And again, that's what you see in the book of Revelation, why Babylon is referred to so frequently there in the book of Revelation. Here, it's Assyria. And I think this is the clue to us as the reader. Don't be thinking so much Babylon literally here, but the Babylonian spirit that is presently manifesting itself as Assyria. And so the Lord is decreeing, I will break Assyria. And of course, this does come true. You know about historically how Hezekiah gets besieged in Jerusalem. And again, it's one of those stories I remember as a kid thinking, you know, oh, it's a great story of God's deliverance and salvation. And it is. And that's what we tend to focus on. You know, boy, you know, things were looking bad and Jerusalem's completely surrounded and Hezekiah's completely threatened, but he just goes to the Lord and he prays and he takes all the threats of the Assyrians and said, you hear what these, you know, Gentiles are blaspheming you and so on and prays for deliverance. And the Lord, you know, miraculously strikes the Assyrian army and, you know, 185,000 die in one night and he has to go back to Assyria. Well, that's an amazing story of God's deliverance, but what we tend to overlook is, you know, God in his great sovereignty could have stopped the Assyrians on the border of Judah. You know, there was a big electric barrier there, and as soon as they tried to cross it, they got electrocuted and died. He didn't do that. God allowed the Assyrians to completely devastate the entire nation. 46 different fortified cities completely obliterated and destroyed by the Assyrians. Lachish being the second most important city in Judah. And Sennacherib was so pleased with himself for having destroyed Lachish. Remember, we showed some pictures earlier of, you know, he had a whole room in his palace, about 100 linear feet of wall space, to decorate with these pictures showing the destruction of the city of Lachish. So it was a real accomplishment. He thought that was worth noting, you know, preserving for posterity. And so God allowed the nation to suffer a great deal of punishment and chastisement, a lot of heartache and death and people taking into slavery. And that was because of the sin and the pride of Judah. Now, they were delivered ultimately. They were not defeated. God did not allow the Assyrians to completely dominate them. Hezekiah and Jerusalem were spared. The temple was spared and so on. But that was because of the faith of Hezekiah. But that same lack of faith and that same pride is what will eventually result in the Babylonians coming back and being the instrument that God uses to punish his people completely. And the city will be destroyed. And the temple will be burned. And the kingdom will be brought to an end. Because all Hezekiah did was buy a little bit of extra time. You know, in some ways you think maybe it'd been better if there were no good kings of Judah, because, you know, it had gotten over with quicker. You know, they're trying to draw out the pain of this thing even longer. And it was clearly the few good kings they had that caused the southern kingdom to last, you know, a little bit longer than their sister to the north. So about 150 years extra they got. But the problems are so deeply rooted in Judah, the same idolatry and faithlessness and pride is what will eventually bring about their downfall. And in Hezekiah, even as good a king as he was and turning to the Lord in faith in a desperate situation, that's not enough to stop the tide of the apostasy of God's people. And that goes back to Guy's question. You know, certain individuals like a prophet like Isaiah, a king like Hezekiah, can make a difference in their own generation. And that's all we can do. And ultimately, of course, you have to say, of course it was good that they had good kings. You wouldn't wish it otherwise. And Josiah will be the last of attempt at a hurrah. But God had already said it's too late, and in a mercy, apparently takes Josiah off the scene to allow the judgment to sweep in. But and so we need to do what we can in the generation that we are, but ultimately a nation is a collection of people, and as a group of people there has to be enough collective consciousness, or at least enough 10 righteous in the nation that can be some kind of mitigating influence on them. All right. Well, I just want to briefly look over these other oracles here. Notice in verse 28, in the year that King Ahaz died, this oracle came. And so this oracle against the Philistines, which has historically been really one of the worst enemies of the Israelites. They're the most warlike neighbor that they've had. And of course was the ancient enemy back in the time of the Judges and the early kingdom period, and David and Solomon and so on. And of course with Ahaz's death, what do you think the neighboring nations around Judah are going to think? Yeah, time to party. You know, every time a king dies and, you know, he's going to be succeeded, you hope that the son will be less experienced. I mean, that goes without saying. And will be less effective in his rule and so on. So the hope is, no, Ahaz is dead now. This is our window of opportunity or hope. Do not rejoice, O Philistia, all of you, because the rod that struck you is broken. For from the serpent's root a viper will come out, and its fruit will be a flying serpent. And so Hezekiah, his son, will still be king, and you will find him even more difficult to deal with. And Hezekiah certainly did exercise a great deal of dominion over the Philistines, partly in his preparations of preparing for the Assyrian besieging of his own nation. And then notice in chapters 15 and 16, we get the Moabites. And again, Moab is located kind of to the southeast of Judah. Again, a neighboring nation. Moab was probably the most common vassal state to Israel, that it probably spent the most time under Israelite or Judean rule, and so would be a very natural neighboring state then to focus on. And so Moab has its own troubles. Surely in a night Ar of Moab is devastated and ruined. Surely in a night Kir of Moab is devastated and ruined. So there's all kinds of troubles going on in Moab. And what this would mean for Judah is perhaps Moab will turn to Judah looking for help and assistance, benevolence, things like that. All that will come to naught because God will bring judgment against Moab as well. There's certain statements in here, you know, like verse 9 of chapter 16, I will weep bitterly for Jazer, for the vine of Sibma. I will drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Elealeh, for the shouting over your summer fruits and your harvest has fallen away. Who is this that's talking? Is this God who's weeping over the sin and devastation? Even though he's the one bringing it, it still breaks his heart to chastise people. That's the way some read this. Others would read this as being the people of Judah, in particular the leadership. They're bemoaning the difficulties that Moab is going through. Again, we can't explore that in all that kind of detail. Chapter 17 now is Damascus, and of course Damascus means who?
Syria.
We even have still the modern state of Syria, with its ancient capital still being Damascus. Some of your translations will say Aram instead of Syria. That's an attempt to everybody and their dog confuses Syria and Assyria because they're so similar in English. But the actual name of Syria was Aram, and the Arameans that make it up, the Assyrians were called that because they worshiped the god Asher, and so they were the Asherites, the Assyrians. And so there really is no connection whatsoever. I don't know why linguistically those two terms are so similar, but So this is not the Assyrians, it's Syria or Aram. And Damascus being the capital, of course, that's a very common thing you find in the prophets. Many of the prophets of the northern kingdom of Israel would say Ephraim, because that tribal territory was the heart of the northern kingdom of Israel. Or they would say Samaria, because that was the main capital, the third and capital that was built and became the permanent place. And so here again, just like we say Washington, what does Washington think? Well, we mean the federal government, we mean the United States acting as the nation and so on. And so again, Damascus is about to remove from being a city, and that of course comes true in 732. The Assyrians come and completely have devastated the city of Damascus and the northern reaches up there. And then this section, chapter 17, verse 12 through chapter 18, is an interesting section because it doesn't begin with this word oracle. You know, all these other passages, like chapter 19, verse 1, it appears again an oracle or a burden about Egypt. And these others have had oracles about them. Now, some people say, well, this is an oracle about Ethiopia because in chapter 18, verse 1, alas, O land of whirring wings, which lies beyond the rivers of Cush, which sends envoys by the sea, even in papyrus vessels on the surface of the waters, go, swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth, to a people feared far and wide, a powerful and oppressive nation whose land the waters divide. And so, they try to fit it into this list of oracles and so on. Maybe the simplest explanation, at least the way I'm taking it here, is that one thing it does at least is it reinforces that God is the one that's completely in charge of all that's going on here. Notice how chapter 18 ends. At that time, a gift of homage will be brought to the Lord of hosts from a people tall and smooth, even from a people feared far and wide, a powerful and oppressive nation whose land the waters divide, same one we read about at the beginning, to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, even Mount Zion. And so here in the middle of this long catalog of various oracles of different nations that impact Judean politics is this reminder that God is the one that's in charge of all these things, and the efforts of men and diplomatic maneuvers and this, that, and the other will come to naught. Well, then, any questions down through chapter 18? Again, we're just kind of doing the overview here. So,
the bringing of the present in verse 7, 18, 7, is a figurative one?
Yeah, I think that's...
it's not changing the religious appearance.
Well, I guess you could say prophetically it could be a type of that.
Does this refer to Ethiopians?
Well, that's what I was saying. Some relate it to that. Because Cush or Ethiopia is mentioned in verse 1, but it really sounds to me just like, he's saying it's someone beyond Ethiopia. It's almost like even nations far, far away are under the control of God. And if you picture it from a Judean perspective, there probably would be a tendency for a lot of people to view God's power as being focused where? Yeah, in Jerusalem, especially in the temple, Jerusalem, Palestine, so the closer you are to there, God really rules. And especially in the ancient world where you think of God's kind of having a home field advantage, but God, you go way beyond Ethiopia and God still rules in the affairs of, whatever's going on anywhere. So again, back in say 17, verse 13, the nations rumble on like the rumbling of many waters, but he will rebuke them and they will flee far away and be chased like chaff in the mountains before the wind, or like whirling dust before a gale. So again, there's all these nations out there just kind of churning and rumbling and, you know, so on. But, you know, God is in control of them all. Well, chapter 19 returns to local Judean politics in the form now of Egypt. And Egypt is particularly important because clearly in every king and his court that existed, and they sat and deliberated the world stage of politics and so on, you're always going to have a faction of your advisors that say the real power in the world lies in Mesopotamia, whether it's the Assyrians right now or later on will be the Babylonians and so on, because that was part of the great cradle of civilization and where these great superpowers were, great armies and all that. And then you're going to have those that say, no, Egypt is where it's at. And again, I don't think it's an accident at all. I mean, here's one of the great coincidences of human existence, if it's a coincidence. It's that this pitiful little band of people that are the descendants of Abraham wind up living in the very place, out of all the places of all the earth in the ancient world, that is the very focus, the crossroads of these two great centers of civilization, the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians. And they're always traipsing right across, right through Palestine. I mean, God could have put them in, you know, Iceland or Australia or somewhere else. They would have been out of the way, you know, unaffected by the nations around them. And yet God put them right smack in the middle of everything. And he did it for a reason. And I suspect it was to bring a knowledge of God to the world. Unfortunately, because of their choices, the world had more of an influence on them than the other way around. But these are the two great powers always vying for control and looking at Palestine as kind of being a buffer zone between the two. If you're in Egypt, you want to control Palestine to kind of hold off any threat from Assyria or Babylon and so on, and vice versa. If you're from Mesopotamia, you want to hold that little strip that guards against any inroads the Egyptians might want to make. And so there's just constant vying back and forth. Well, we know from history that Egypt's glory days are over by this point. You know, by the 700s BC, Egypt was nothing like her former self. But how do you know that at the time? I mean, here we are living in America. Are the greatest days of America yet to come? Or are they behind us? You have no way of knowing. Now, 1,000 years from now, you could probably look in a history book and saying, yeah, here, you know, this is the date, this is the president it started with, or whatever, you know. You know, maybe it's Woodrow Wilson. I mean, I don't know. But in history, people will say this is when the decline of America began and so on. Well, you can always hope that this is just a little dip in the road and we're going to equal our previous greatness or even more so. And so Egypt always had this dream of reattaining her former glory of the New Kingdom period. You know, people like Ramses II and Thutmose III and so on. Great world empire, superpower, and so on. Well, they're still powerful enough. They're a force to be reckoned with, and they're always trying to influence politics in their favor. And so, again, they are a constant temptation for the people of Judah to say, let's make an alliance with Egypt. The Assyrians are a big threat, and if you're worried enough about the Assyrians, make a deal with the Egyptians to form an alliance that'll help guard against the Assyrians. And they do that. And the Egyptians even send an army to try to help out. And it's too feeble. The Assyrians are able to beat off the Egyptian army and resume the sacking of Judah. And it's just like batting at a fly, you know. No problem at all for them. And again, the only thing that delivers them in the end is God's response to Hezekiah's faithfulness. And so what we have in chapters 19 through 20 is a warning. Ultimately, the purpose of it is to warn Judah against dependence upon Egypt. Behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is about to come to Egypt. The idols of Egypt will tremble at his presence, and the heart of the Egyptians will melt within them. I will incite Egyptians against Egyptians. They will fight against his brother and each against his neighbor, city against city and kingdom against kingdom. And so that's not anybody you're going to be able to rely upon or depend upon. Waters from the sea will dry up in verse 5. That kind of reminds you of God's parting of the Red Sea and so on, and the power he exhibited originally against Egypt. He is still the same God who still wields power. Verse 16 of chapter 19, in that day the Egyptians will become like women. They will tremble and be in dread because of the waving of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which he's going to wave over them. Can you picture the power that God can have just to kind of, you know, wave over a nation and it just falls to pieces? You know, it's not like God's got to really work hard at it and break a sweat and do a lot of smashing. He can just wave his hand. And of course, that's imagery. God wouldn't even have to do that. Doesn't even have to bat an eye. And he can bring nations up or down. And so, again, there's all this judgment that is coming. Well, I think our time is about up here. I want to say a few more things here about Egypt. What we'll do next time, if you will, is read from chapter 19 through chapter 23, and we'll see if we can finish that particular section. We'll talk about Egypt. I have a few extra things to say about that. Then you'll kind of follow this progression of destruction by the Assyrians through chapter 21 and 22. And then the latter part of chapter 22, you get this interesting story about Shebna and Eliakim, which are two of the leaders in Judah. They're not the king. Hezekiah is the king, but they are the king's right-hand men, and the one's being booted out because he's not done his job very well, and another one's going to be put in his place, and ultimately, of course, that is not the solution either, but what it focuses on is a lot of the problems of Judah are going to be traced back to their poor leadership, and it highlights, of course, a couple of things, that those great visions of the rule of God's kingdom back in chapter 9, chapter 11, you know, this child that's going to be born and he's going to be called Wonderful Counselor and Eternal Father and so on, that isn't really going to be fulfilled in a man like Hezekiah because such men are flawed and themselves in need of help. And it points that ultimately the only one that could truly fulfill these prophecies would be a great king, a perfect king, who will be none other than Jesus, the Christ. And so we will see language, however, is taken from Isaiah 22 here and used of Jesus in the New Testament. And that'll be kind of interesting. So see if you can spot that and figure out where it is. But we'll see if we can get through from chapter 19 through 23 next week. Maybe a little ambitious, but nothing if not ambitious, I guess.